behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bullen.
Ben, we've got a topic today that is a listener suggestion, actually multiple listener suggestions. Mm-hmm. So I guess we should mention both of these people, right? Probably,
yeah.
To be fair, right? We got an email recently, very recently, at the end of June from Daniel JP, and we'll leave it at JP, just to keep the anonymity a bit here. And Daniel says, I've been listening to you guys for about 3 years, and have just about listened to every episode. Well, congratulations
wow.
on that, by the way.
That's no small achievement.
It is not. There's approaching 600 episodes at this point.
Yes, sir.
All right, so he says, here is an idea. The history of Jeep, where did it come from? How did it get its name? And so that was a pretty simple email, right?
Mm-hmm.
We had another one, though, that this reminded me of, because in... when was this? Earlier June, so same month, we had another suggestion on Facebook from someone who writes to us often. His name is Mark Fleury. And I'm going to say his full name because that's out there on Facebook anyways.
Hey, Mark. What's
yep.
going on?
And Mark says, hey, Scott and Ben, I recently purchased my first Jeep. It's a 2014 Wrangler Unlimited JKU. JKU. It's a JK. Unlimited. He says, this is a dream vehicle for me, and I waited 20 years to get this one, which brings me to my point. Jeep Wrangler has a long history here in America, and I would love a podcast on the Willys and other models. I attached a photo of me and my new love, and that's actually his, what do you call it, Ben? An avatar? Whatever.
Yeah, profile picture.
Exactly right. So you can go to our site and see Mark in his Jeep if you'd like to.
Mm-hmm.
And for the record, Ben, Fiestas are for girls. Just kidding, Mr. Benjamin. Oh, so that's a jab at me, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I happen to like the Ford Fiesta Ford Festivas and all those.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, okay. Well, we'll still go through with your topic here, Mark, but...
I like that you forgot about that last line.
Yeah. Shoot. I should have left that out.
Oh, well, it's, you know what? That's the beauty of recording live, right?
That's all right, Mark. No offense taken. I know he's kidding. He loves, Fiestas too.
First off, congratulations as well on your 2014 Jeep Wrangler. That's cool. Daniel, Mark, we really appreciate these emails, and it got us thinking that it had been a long time since we covered the history of a specific car or a company.
That's right. And this is, you know, it's going to be kind of a longer podcast, and we'll attempt to get kind of all the information in here. But as always, I mean, you know, we're a bit limited in what we can do with a couple of hours of material. If it's going to last that long, we'll see. I assume it will. And, you know, we've got all kinds of notes here, Ben. I'm going to apologize early because I'm going to do a lot of note shuffling in this one. I've got so much material on the Jeep because it's a complex history.
Yeah, it's an institution, man.
It really is. Now, I want to start with this question, though.
Okay.
Who do you associate the Jeep brand with the most, Ben? And I mean, when I say this, I'll kind of explain it. Do you see it as kind of like a standalone brand, you know, like no larger association like that? Well, that's a Jeep, and that's just the Jeep brand, and Jeep makes that product, and that's it. Or do you associate them with, I guess most recently, Fiat, who is the parent company now?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you think of it as like a Chrysler vehicle because, you know, it's Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep has been the marketing for so long.
Yeah.
You know, we seem to hear that a lot here. Or do you think of Jeep as like AMC, because, you know, they've built Jeeps for almost 20 years. And then
sure.
What about Kaiser and Willys and Ford? Ford has a lot to do with this if you go back to World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And what about Bantam? I mean,
mm-hmm.
all these companies, as we'll tell you in just a minute, you know, the years when they were associated with Jeep, there's a tie-in with Jeep, the Jeep brand, and all of those companies in some way. But how do you feel about it? Like, do you feel about it like it, I mean, how do you see the Jeep brand?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. Personally, you know, being that you and I are from the States, I always think of Chrysler just because that's what we always hear.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is a funny thing I was thinking of earlier, when I think of old school Jeeps, for some reason, instead of thinking of World War II, my mind immediately goes to the show MASH.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, because it's set in, what was it, Scott? It's a...
Korea.
Right, Korea.
Yep, they're fighting the Korean
Not
War.
Not Vietnam, it's the Korean War.
That's right. So, yeah, I can understand that. I mean, if that's your association with it, I tend to see it as a standalone, because, well, it's, I mean, Jeep just seems like it's its own brand. It's so different, so unique from everything else out there. I mean,
yeah.
But I also, you know, I'm gonna give a little asterisk and say that, you know, all the marketing that we've been hearing for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, it's
Chrysler.
Always Chrysler Dodge Jeep dealerships,
yep.
right? You always
yep.
say, come down to your Chrysler Dodge Jeep dealerships mm-hmm. to get information. And it doesn't matter if it's a Chrysler commercial, a Dodge commercial, or a Jeep commercial. You hear that three-brand marketing, and that always gets me. So I associate the brand with all three, but I guess when I look at one, I think that's just its own standalone brand. I don't see it as like – I definitely don't yet associate it with Fiat.
It's not that common for a brand to be so – popular and so well understood in the public sphere, mm-hmm. Considering how often Jeep is moved around, it's always in the back of my mind, like, should I start associating them with Fiat? Because are they going to go somewhere else? Is Elon Musk going to buy the Jeep brand?
You know, I don't know. Jeep has a history of well, they've got, they've marketed or they've licensed
yeah.
their product out so that it can be created or built in many, many different places mm-hmm. all around the world, which we'll mention, I'm sure, at some
right,
point in this
yeah.
podcast. But, if you want to get right down to it, I mean, we can talk about, you know, sure, they're owned by Fiat now.
Right. Because Fiat owns Chrysler and, Chrysler Corporation first got the Jeep brand in 1987, I want to say.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I can go through the list here in just a second if
yeah.
you want. And I feel would be remiss if we didn't mention Toledo, Ohio with this right now. And let's just get this out of the way because Toledo has always been very proud of the Jeep brand and the Jeep name.
Mm-hmm.
They've had a lot to do with it from the very beginning, as we'll talk about. But the original complex, you know, where they assembled Jeeps, you know, beginning in the 1940s all the way through, oh boy, I want to say like early 2000s, maybe something like that. I have the dates kind of mixed up here, but
yeah.
The original Toledo complex was standing for a long, long time until they split off to a newer factory. It's located also still in Toledo or nearby anyways, but you could drive by the original Toledo factory for a long time. I lived in Toledo and you could drive by their factory. And they had, you know, twin smokestacks that said Overland on them from the Willys Overland company.
Wow.
And those stood until, I believe, 2007 on that same site. And, you know, for a long time, as a kid, it was always a big kick for me to go by the Jeep factory. And you would see the actual Jeep products on top of the building on the big sign that says Jeep out front.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really, really cool because, you know, not a lot of, I guess I wasn't around a lot of automobile manufacturing companies, you know, when I lived in Toledo.
Right.
I wasn't getting up to Detroit when I was a young kid by any means. So, I didn't see them display things like that. You know, you'd find, you know, when there's a junkyard or something, they would put a car on a sign. You know, it's different than that. I mean, they had several products on the roof of the current products up on the
mm-hmm.
roof of the building. It was really a neat display. If you ever got a chance to see it, it's something that would stick out in your mind.
Quick question here before we dive into definitions and history.
Sure.
Scott, is it true that you used to own a Jeep?
Oh, me? No, my wife owned them. But they've been in the family.
Okay.
And my brother has owned one. He's owned a Wrangler. Mm-hmm. And my wife, we've had four Jeep products since I've been with her. And, that's a Jeep Wrangler.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Cherokee and then we had two Jeep Liberty products. So, you know, and we're looking to buy another one. I think that, the JK Unlimited, the one that, that Mark has, the four door,
yeah.
is something that she would love to have another one of those. And we're kind of in the middle of, you know, deciding what color and what options
mm-hmm.
and all that stuff and what year really, because I don't think new is for us, but, maybe a year or two used.
Yeah, okay. Now,
how about you? Have you have any Jeep experience?
I have none. Oddly enough, my girlfriend, I think her first car was a Jeep Cherokee.
Hmm.
And, you know, when you're in high school, that's fantastic because you can take a bunch of people places. It's not, you know, I had a grandma car and, I think a lot of people end up having that, you know, the hand-me-down.
There is no doubt that a Jeep Wrangler that, you know, has the, or CJ or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, model that you had, you know, the open top, those are so much fun. In high school, especially, I mean, that's a blast to drive something like that. I had some friends that had like old Jeepster models,
mm-hmm.
From the '60s, which are
wow.
really cool. It's a neat vehicle.
One of my high school buddies did have the open air Wrangler and yeah, that thing was cool. We did have some last minute weather situations where you had to pull over and put the top
oh, sure.
on.
put the overly complex top up because I think they fixed it now. We've talked about that on some previous podcasts.
Yeah.
Is, you know, that specific top because it was difficult to get up on the, well, she had a 94 Wrangler, the mm-hmm. one that I was mentioning. And it was very difficult to get that thing stretched the right way and put on exactly right. But I think they've really, really improved the design.
Yeah, they have. Because I'll tell you, that old design, especially if you were in a hurry.
Oh, yeah, there's no way. The older design was a little bit tougher. So just, I guess going way, way back, let's talk about ownership, and then we can kind of move on from here.
Yeah. So are we talking about once upon a time, like in the beginning?
In the very beginning. So, you know, we can go to the history right after this, but I just want to tell you all the different companies that have owned the Jeep name over the years, starting around 1944, because that's when the trademark name was allowed.
Right, which is a story in itself, and the winner of that trademark was Willys Overland.
Exactly right. So from 1944 to 1953, Willys Overland was the one who built the Jeep product. And then in 1953 to 1964, it was Kaiser Jeep.
But wait.
What's that?
They called themselves something different.
Yeah, they called themselves Willys Motors, which is a little tricky, I guess, because you're still trying to use the old Willys name at that point. But then in 1964 to 1970, they did go with Kaiser Jeep. Mm-hmm. So it gets a little complicated here in the way that they name things and who really owns them. In 1970, AMC owned the Jeep name, along with Renault, who had, I guess, controlling production towards the end of this, which was around 1986, 1987. Mm-hmm. And that's right about when Chrysler did the AMC buyout. And they bought AMC in 1986, I believe. Mm-hmm. And by 1987, the Jeep name was part of Chrysler all the way through 1998. And, that's also when the Wrangler was developed.
Yep.
And then the switch over from the CJ model to the Wranglers we'll talk about later too.
And then in 98 to about, what would you say, Scott, 07, it was Daimler Chrysler AG.
And that's simply because Daimler purchased Chrysler at that point, and that was the switch over there. And then it went back to Chrysler again in 2007, as you'll know, Chrysler LLC from 2007 to 2009. And then from 2009 to 2013, they're known as Chrysler Group LLC, which is part of the Fiat Group of Automobiles.
Yep.
And I think right now it's even something different. So from 2014 on, or from, you know, till now, it's called Fiat Chrysler Automobiles is who the official owner of the Jeep brand is. So it's a little overly complicated. It doesn't have to be that complicated. It seems like you can break this down to about three or four owners, really.
Right.
It's all these little footnotes and side notes in history that that make it seem overly complex.
Yeah, like a bunch of asterisks.
Exactly.
So
I'm glad you said it, not me.
One thing we have to point out is that it's not unreasonable that this brand would have so many owners, and there are two primary factors, I argue. And number one is that it is a tremendously successful brand. Tremendously. Actually, this might interest some of our buffs out here. It's the oldest off-road, those Willys MB Jeeps are the oldest off-road vehicles. The civilian models came out in 45 after they got the trademark, but when it was the Army, the first ones, they were making them in 41.
Yeah.
But you couldn't buy them.
And that goes back, only about a half a year prior to that, because there's an extremely ramped up version of the way that these things, came to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's super fast. The development of the Jeep came about, I want to say almost overnight, but it's more like 2 days.
Yeah, and that second reason, of course, is just the age of this. Little bit of trivia for anybody out there. The second oldest four-wheel drive brand is Land Rover.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I kind of would have guessed that, I think, because I see a bunch of old Land Rover vehicles all over the place. All right, so.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go back to 1940, and I wasn't kidding when I said 2 days. That's how quickly the design went from here's our idea to, I'm going to send in this design draft to the U.S. Army. So it does happen really quick. Now, we're talking about mid-1940.
Yeah.
I think it was June, July, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was apparent that the U.S. was going to be involved in the conflict happening over in Europe. We're going to be at war. It's because what's going to happen here. There's no doubt about it. We're going to be drawn in, right?
Right.
This is prior to Pearl Harbor or any of that. Mm-hmm. So,
but the writing was on the wall.
Exactly
so to speak.
Right. Yeah. So the Army decides that they're going to request bids from 135 different companies for a working prototype of a four-wheel drive reconnaissance car. Now, the companies had just 49 days to build, again, a working prototype.
Yeah.
And only two companies initially responded. It was the American Bantam Car Company and Willys Overland.
Yeah, and at the time, let's just think about how quickly 49 days can pass when you're trying to build a vehicle. Specifically, what they wanted was a four-wheel drive vehicle with 1/2 to 1.5 ton capacity for reconnaissance, what we would call a light utility vehicle today. Mm-hmm. And I've got some of the original specs here if you'd like to hear them.
Yeah, definitely I would.
Okay, great. So originally they said we wanted this to weigh 1,300 pounds, but that was not going to work.
That's very lightweight.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. The Jeeps are light, but they're not that light. That's like tissue paper. They upped it later to 2,160. And I wonder if part of that is that only two companies out of those 135 responded.
Well, maybe it could be. I mean, maybe that's it. Maybe they said, well, here's what we're getting. And it seems like this is the trend or the way we're going with this.
Right. They said it had to have at least a 600-pound payload, four-wheel drive. Wheelbase could not be more than 80 inches and tread could not exceed 47 inches. Got to be at least six inches for ground clearance, and they wanted it to have a decent enough cooling system to allow sustained low speed without overheating the engine. So in a way, like the weight itself just seems kind of high in the sky.
Well, because you're talking about a vehicle that is supposed to be battle ready,
right?
That's going to be able to make quick trips out to the front of the field and be able to deliver troops or weaponry, whatever it happens to be, and then get back out quickly as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it had to be, very, very agile, very capable, also lightweight and have all this clearance and four-wheel drive capability and all that. I mean, all this plays into, something that no one had ever seen at this point. I mean, it's unlike any other vehicle anybody had ever seen. And Bantam Car Company was the one who stepped up first and said, here's our design. And they literally did this, Ben. They submitted the first idea on paper in something like 2 days.
Right. Yeah.
And the guy that did it, his name was Carl Probst, I believe.
Detroit engineer. He was a freelancer, which is really interesting because he had worked with a couple of different companies there, and he had a pretty good rep. Willys Overland, the other company that responded, asked for more time.
Okay, so now the 2 day thing, that's just submitting a drawing
just
idea.
Just the paper, yeah.
Exactly right. And Probst did this a little bit against his will a little bit at first. You know that he actually declined Bantam's first request for this. He said, I can't do that. I there's no way I can do it. Cause at the time, you got to remember the Bantam Car Company, and this is another little side note here, I guess. The Bantam Car Company was bankrupt at this time.
Yeah, so they had no engineers.
They have nothing. They had laid off all of their engineers at this point. So the Bantam Car Company saying, like, we can do this, but we're going to have to hire somebody from an outside firm and say that it's our design, which is no problem. They do that all the time, but Carl was looking at this saying, this is probably a bad idea for me to work for a bankrupt car company.
Right. With 2 days, this is kind of ludicrous.
Yeah, yeah. And even the 45-day thing to get it all together, because he's going to have to see it from beginning to end.
Right.
So, just coming up with the initial design wasn't the problem. It's more like, well, is Bantam going to really come through with this? And am I going to get my check at the end of this?
Now, right.
So he decided to decline their first offer, but then he got a second request from somebody that he said, well, I better stand up and take notice of this, right?
Yeah, it was a request from the Army saying, hey, will you work with these guys?
So I guess the U.S. Army holds a little bit more weight to him than the Bantam Car Company did at the time.
Well, it's kind of a can you do your civic duty?
And that was very much the feel of U.S. citizens at the time is that,
right.
Stand up and do what you can for the cause, right? For the effort.
Right. So starting on July 17th, 1940, Carl Probst is working like a madman. So as you said, he's got the blueprint submitted just a few days later.
Yeah, by the 19th, I believe,
mm-hmm.
of July.
Right, yeah. The hand-built prototype, which came out of Butler, Pennsylvania, goes to Maryland in September for Army testing, and it performed with flying colors on everything except for the torque. It needed 80 pounds of torque, I think.
Interesting. And the small engine that the Bantam had put in there just wasn't quite doing it. Now, I got another quick side note here, if you don't mind.
It's
something I read somewhere. It said that Bantam at the time was one of the manufacturers that could easily do this because they were accustomed to building small, lightweight, four-cylinder engine vehicles when most of the U.S. car companies had already switched over to making big six-cylinder and eight-cylinder engines because they had a much larger product line.
Yeah.
The Bantam Car Company had already been building small vehicles that that were, I guess, easily adapted into this type of design. Mm-hmm. So they had kind of a foot up in this situation.
Yeah, but they also had a foot down, Scott, because in addition to being bankrupt, they were, in Uncle Sam's opinion, too small to build all the Jeeps they needed.
That's right. So what they did, and this is kind of interesting, because if you look at the early designs, and I printed some of these out, Ben. I've got three examples here.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll talk about these, but these are the three designs that eventually came to be. Now, we've mentioned two already. We mentioned the Bantam vehicle, which they called the Bantam Reconnaissance Car.
Right. None of these were called Jeeps yet.
No, not yet. And then there was the Ford Pygmy.
Right.
Which is the one that, the Ford developed much later.
Yeah.
And then the other one was the Willys Quad design.
Ah, which looks so very similar.
Well, they all three do, really, as a matter
right.
of fact. And the reason is because, you know, you mentioned that they said the Bantam Car Company is probably too small to build what the U.S. military would need. It was a small car company, really. It wasn't very big.
Yep.
And they said, well, I just don't know if you can handle this type of production that we're talking about initially. So, they took, with Bantam's approval, they said, we love your design, but we're going to maybe give this to another couple of people that have also submitted ideas, which, you know, turned out there were three in the end. Initially, it was just Bantam and Willys.
Right.
Ford jumped in as well, but a little bit later. And they said, we're going to give you the Bantam Reconnaissance Car design, you know, Ford and Willys. Take a look at that and improve on it how you will. You know, do with it what you can. But this is a good start.
Yeah, and once they had these three different companies working on the same idea, Willys and Ford both started making some tweaks and improvements to the prototypes the government was fine with. The chief engineer of Willys at the time, a guy named Delmer Roos, made changes to hit a revised weight specification, and he was able to use the Willys engine in there. Willys had this very popular engine at the time, right?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Go Devil.
The Go Devil, that's exactly right. And that's what they went with, and that apparently that met the torque specs that they needed that they didn't hit earlier with the Bantam design. So all this is working together, right? I mean, everything, Willys is putting their part in, and Ford is also putting their parts in, and together they're building one vehicle. All three of these companies are building one vehicle that's going to be the one that they eventually go with. And just I get so many side notes on this one, Ben.
No, it's fun.
A side note, Ford actually submitted two different designs. There was the Pygmy design, and then they also had a Bud-bodied vehicle that's from the Bud Company, which is a metal fabrication company, a supplier, I guess. They built things like stainless steel rail cars and things like that. There was also a Bud-bodied vehicle that was never tested that Ford submitted. And I don't know why it was never tested, but they went with the Pygmy over the Bud design. So that's just kind of a historical side note or footnote that that most people probably haven't heard about.
Right. And we do know that each of these companies found some neat stuff there. Like we mentioned, the Willys, Go Devil performing, just a specific here, it hit 105 pound-feet of torque. And the Pygmy had 85 and Bantam had at the end 83. But now that they had all three of these people working with specifications.
And one more thing.
Yes.
I just have to add it.
Yeah.
Spicer. Spicer supplied the all-wheel drive components because that was relatively unusual at the time. And they said, here's one four-wheel drive unit that we believe in, that we think is something that, you should all use in all of these designs.
Right.
And so they supplied them, identical or nearly identical drive components from Spicer, which is owned by, I believe, Dana Corporation, which if you're a Jeep owner now, you know about Dana Axles, which I guess we'll talk about later as well. So, okay, I didn't mean to interrupt, but we can't leave Spicer out of the story.
We cannot, because Spicer comes into the story for modern age Jeep drivers. So during World War II, when we pull back a little bit and just look at the production here, we've got Willys and Ford cranking away, and they fill out more than 700,000 units.
Yeah, and that's in 4 years.
Yeah, in 4 years.
4 years, 700,000 Jeep products are coming out of Ford and Willys. And, I mean, of course, you know, the servicemen, they absolutely love this design. They think that it's fantastic. I mean, it's so purposeful. It's like nothing that anybody had ever seen before. Yep. Brand new vehicle on the field. They think it's fantastic.
It's rugged. It can go anywhere in comparison to anything that's not a tank at the time. It's also super simple. It doesn't have a whole bunch of bells and whistles, which means that while you might not have heated seats or something, you are able to fix it in the field.
And this vehicle had so many characteristics that made it, I guess battle ready. You know, that it was a perfect match from the very beginning.
Yep.
And there's a list here on one of these articles that I'm reading that says that it was, you know, not only was it an excellent reconnaissance car, but it was also a great weapons platform, an ambulance, a troop transport, equipment hauler, could be used as a tractor. It could be used as a railroad locomotive when it was fitted with special wheels, which I didn't know about. In addition to that, the flat hood that was on this Jeep design could be used for a dinner table, an operating table, a map table, or even an altar out in the field. So, you know, there's so many different purposes. And that's just a small smattering of what you could do with these things. I mean, it is really extremely versatile, and it's something that they've capitalized on for the last, you know, 70 years, I guess, at this point. I mean, they still play up that capability, that versatility in their marketing.
And the public loved it as much as the military. If you go on YouTube right now, guys, you can see so many archival clips of people driving Jeeps all around, you know, driving Jeeps the way that people would ride a skateboard today.
Yeah, good point. You know, of course, millions of military men, literally millions of military men, come back and say, I drove this vehicle in the field, you know, when I was at war, and I loved everything about it. I mean, it was really a cool thing. I'd love a version of this for the street, if that's possible. Let's see if we can get a civilian version of the Jeep for daily use.
Right, or maybe more accurately, a civilian version of the Quad. But they, you know what? This is the greatest way for us to segue to the old debate, Scott, which you and I have our opinions on. Mm-hmm. How and when did Jeeps become Jeeps?
Ah, okay, that's good. We got to talk about, man, there's a lot to talk about here. You talk about the Jeep name? Are you talking about the trademark name?
Oh, let's talk about
the origin of the term.
Let's talk about the origin of the name,
okay.
And then we should definitely talk about the trademark too.
All right, and then we'll get back to civilian Jeeps, because I think that's a point that we definitely need to cover here.
Yeah.
All right, so the origin of the Jeep name. Now, this is something that there's a lot of discussion about this, right? Because there's a theory that says that the military designation for Jeep, which was the government purpose or general purpose vehicle, was kind of slurred by one of the generals, I guess, who was driving this, or somebody that was driving one of these at one of the early events, one of the early press events, and they thought it was just a mispronunciation of GP, and they misconstrued that as being the word Jeep. And kind of like I think the example they give is like, it's similar to the way HMMWV is used for Humvee, I guess, not Hummer. In a similar way, I think it was Joe Frazier who, the Willys Overland president who from 1939 to 1944, who I think he's the one who coined the term, they said, by slurring the initials GP.
He says he coined the term.
Well, that's the thing. Later on, it's easy to say, like, I came up with this, right? That was the one who first said this.
Right. And going back to that, the note you had about the famous test driving thing, right? There was a columnist, Catherine Hillier, working for the Washington Daily News, who asked what the Willys vehicle was called when they were driving it up the states of the U.S. Capitol. And the test driver, Irving Red Houseman, apparently had heard people at Fort Hollibird calling it a Jeep. And so he said that. And it is true that in February of 41, Hillier's article published that. And it did say that, well, I'll go ahead and read it. With Senator Meade of New York at the wheel and Representative Thomas of New Jersey sitting beside him, one of the Army's new scout cars, known as Jeeps or Quads, climbs the Capitol step in a demonstration yesterday. Soldiers in the rear seat for gunners were unperturbed.
Now, you and I both watched that video.
Yeah.
We've seen this online. It's easy to see it's the old film footage.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible how quickly that Jeep climbs those stairs and with zero effort.
It just scoots up and it doesn't look like it's going to tip or in any way unstable.
A huge staircase. I mean, stairway, several flights.
Yeah.
I mean, it climbs it so quickly. It's just unlike anything anybody had ever seen at that point. It was a unique vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. I mean, it's a standout today. They still use the stair climbing thing as a demonstration, I believe.
Yeah, it's a good demonstration. And as we'll find, that's not the only demonstration. So, as far as we can tell, although there are some alternate theories about what happened to give the Jeep its name, as far as we can tell, that article is where it really got popularized as a phrase with everyone.
Yeah, and the term Jeep, now, you mentioned that it was just kind of offhandedly mentioned, like, well, that's a Jeep. That came from a military term that predated the 1940 invention of the Jeep, or the drawing of the Jeep.
Yeah.
So it goes way back to, I think it's 1914, when U.S. Army mechanics, which were assigned to test new vehicles, anything that was an untested new vehicle, I believe, was called a Jeep at the time, right?
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of the slang, and you can look up, some of these military slang definitions if you want to. One of them that was published in 1942 in the library at the Pentagon gives this definition of the word Jeep. It says it's a four-wheel drive vehicle of 1.5 to 1.5 ton capacity for reconnaissance or any other Army duty. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess that's just after the Jeep was already developed, right? But
yeah.
There are other vehicles that have also been called Jeep prior to the 1940 invention of what we consider the Jeep design.
Mm.
So it wasn't just like, it's stuck with this one vehicle. Well, you know what? Actually, it is a kind of...
It did stick with that vehicle
I guess it did because they saw a chance to capitalize on it for the civilian market, right?
Yes, which goes into the next big point we have to make about the name, the trademark.
Yeah, that's right, the trademark.
Sorry, I don't know why I had a German accent for a second.
That's okay, no problem. But I guess in when was it? It was in 1943, I believe, that Willys Overland, they decided, and this is still where the war is going on, Willys Overland decides that they're going to trademark the Jeep brand name for themselves because they're creating this thing. And at the time, towards the end of the war, I think Ford had stopped production, and that's an important point to make because if Ford had stuck with building the Jeep product or Jeep-like products,
mm-hmm.
Would have a completely different product out there at this point that looks an awful lot like the Jeep, I believe, because it was so popular. But Willys Overland wanted to stick with it for a civilian version they knew that they were going to build later. And it wasn't for another 7 years that they got that, that trademark name approved.
Yeah, 1950, right?
It was 1950 before Willys Overland was finally granted privilege of owning the Jeep brand name as a registered trademark. So it takes a long, long time to get something like that through.
And every company that's owned Jeep since, right, has prized and protected this trademark, even unto Fiat in the present day. Why? Well, maybe war correspondent Ernie Pyle says it the best in this article he wrote. He described the Jeep as faithful as a dog, strong as a mule, and as agile as a goat.
Not bad. Those are pretty good characteristics, I would think, to have for a vehicle that you count on out in the field, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
So, and these translated over to the civilian Jeep, which we just had mentioned early on. There's a version called the Jeep CJ. And CJ stands for civilian Jeep, of course, and that's the public version of the military Jeep from World War II that people just fell in love with. And these were built from 1944 all the way through 1986. And that was that critical time when AMC and Chrysler, I guess Chrysler was taking over AMC at that point. And so they lasted all the way through the end of the AMC ownership. And the CJ7 or CJ8 versions, which was where AMC was at in production at the point when Chrysler purchased them, that was what gave way to the Wrangler, which came about first in 1986 with Chrysler. And it's kind of interesting to think that, this body style, this body design, because you can look at an old, a really old CJ body.
Yeah.
And you can still see the modern Wrangler in that design.
That's true. And we should also note while we're doing this, Scott, that we're, again, not going into the small differences between every CJ because, there's the 5, there's the 6, there's the 3.
It seems like we could do a podcast on just the differences between individual models if we wanted to do that, but that would just be way too time consuming for this one, so we're not gonna get into that kind of detail here.
I do want to point out as we get toward, let's see, we've talked about the name. Oh, there is one other theory about the name, which is that it refers to Eugene the Jeep, right?
Yeah, that's right. That was the Popeye character, which was kind of his sidekick, right?
Yep. And I can't believe we didn't say that. Now, personally, I don't think that's it.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, because the Eugene the Jeep thing, that came about around March of 1936, I believe. It's an E.C. Seeger cartoon. And Eugene the Jeep was Popeye's, like I said, sidekick, but jungle pet, I guess is what they called it. Small, able to move between dimensions and could solve seemingly impossible problems. Mm-hmm. I could understand why they would attach the word Jeep with it, because that was Eugene the Jeep, obviously.
Large and, slang, right?
Yeah, I mean, I could see why they would attach that that set of characteristics to this vehicle, because, you know, it's small, it's able to get around, you know, seemingly impossible problems, exactly like you know, exactly the way Eugene the Jeep could. So I can understand the tie-in with that, but that is not where the name came from.
Right. And let's go ahead and point out also that the Jeep during the war and post-World War II became popular across the globe, not just in the United States. Now, at this point, man, we're about 40 minutes in, and we have to do a part two of this. I can't stop here.
I think you're right. Now, there's so much more to go here. I've got a pile of notes in front of me. Oh man, Ben, I still want to talk about things like, I mean, just upcoming, just kind of a
teaser
where we're going to go, I guess. I mean, we can talk about, you know, some of the Jeep models, the current Jeep models. Mm-hmm. We can talk about the Rubicon Trail, maybe.
Oh yeah,
I think that's important to Jeep owners. What about you know, some of the gatherings? You know, the Camp Jeep and Jeep 101 and the Jeep Jamborees and all that. We haven't talked about any of that yet. We haven't talked about dispatch vehicles. Maybe we should lead off with that next time. But, yeah, we're going to have to come back for another episode.
All right. Well, again, Daniel JP and Mark Fleury, thank you guys so much for writing to us with this excellent suggestion. We are going to go off and prepare for the second part of our Jeep podcast coming up very soon. In the meantime, if you have a suggestion for something you'd like to see us cover, check us out on Facebook or Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW. You can also find our very own website, CarStuffShow.com, or just send us an email. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.